For those of you who weren't able to attend lecture today, we did get the first exam back, and I'm going to review the answers to the exam. So the first question, you had three different statements, and you were supposed to determine whether the statement was the law of conservation of mass, the law of definite proportions, or law of multiple proportions. So just to state what each of the laws was before we get to the sentences, law of conservation of mass says that in a chemical reaction, you can change the types of materials, the types of substances present, but you can't change the total number of atoms, you can't change the total amount of mass. Law of definite proportion says that if you have a particular substance, it's going to have the same formula no matter where you find that substance. So in other words, a specific substance always has the same chemical formula. And then law of multiple proportions says that you can have elements that can combine in different ratios in order to come up with different substances. So the first statement, which was carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen can combine to produce both ascorbic acid, which is vitamin C, and glucose, which is blood sugar, well, that's the law of multiple proportions because you have one set of elements that are creating different substances. The second statement, 100 grams of mercury 2 oxide decomposes into 92.61 grams of mercury metal and 7.39 grams of oxygen gas. This was actually one of the historical experiments that led to the discovery of gases because eventually someone came up with the idea of trying to measure these types of processes in a container, where this gas that was given off that was invisible turned out to add up to the total mass. And so this is the law of conservation of mass, because you start with 100 grams, you end up with 100 grams. And then the last one, both artificial and naturally occurring vanillin have a chemical formula of C8H8O3. So that was trying to say that no matter the source, the vanillin always has the same chemical formula. So that's the law of definite proportions. Now, question two. There was a lot of partial credit on this one. You were asked to, for each of the examples in here, state whether these following terms were appropriate or not. You had molecule, substance, compound, and mixture. So remember, a molecule is a set of atoms that are all bound together. A substance is something that has the same chemical formula throughout. A compound is something that's made up of two or more elements. And a mixture is where you have two or more substances. So for the first one, water, it's a substance, because it's got the same chemical formula throughout water. It also exists as molecules. So you have two hydrogens that are connected to just one oxygen to make up a molecule of water. And because you have two different elements that are going into it, it is also a compound. So these questions were graded on partial credit, where if you had all three of these things for the first one, you got all 3 points. Each one of these was worth 3 points each. And if you're missing one or two of them, then you got partial credit accordingly. For sodium chloride, that's two different elements, so it's a compound. But it's not a molecule. Sodium chloride is exactly an example of something that does not exist in molecule form. But it is a substance, because it'll have the same chemical formula throughout. Seawater. The best answer for this was mixture, because you have a variety of substances that are going to show up in seawater. But if you said compound, I went ahead and gave you credit for that, because yes, the water that's part of seawater is a compound. If you said substance, I accepted that because, yes, there's different substances that are in water. And even if you said molecule, well, water itself is a molecule. So you could have answered anything for that question, but the one thing you had to have, because the one thing that best described it, was mixture. And then the last one, hydrogen gas, H2. Hydrogen is a molecule. It's just two hydrogens stuck together. It's a substance because it's got the same formula throughout. It's not a compound because it's only one element, and it's not a mixture because it's just a single substance. So any questions on the first two problems? Okay, moving on to the third one. You're told that you have 2.51 moles of sucrose, which is table sugar. And you're given that the formula of that is C12H22O11. You're asked to calculate how many grams is present in this number of moles. So this is something that's come up again in one of the recent chapters we covered, because we've just been working on stoichiometry and calculating amounts of reactants and products. So you know that the mole is a way of representing a certain amount of material. It's equal to a certain number of atoms or molecules, but that number, that 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd, is not something that we normally use in practical sense. And it doesn't come up in the problem here because we can go straight from moles to grams by coming up with the molar mass. So in order to get the molar mass, we take each of the individual atomic masses and we multiply it by how many atoms we have. So there's 12 carbons, and each carbon has an atomic mass of 12.01 if we round to the last two digits. There are 22 hydrogens, and each hydrogen is 1.01. And then there's 11 oxygens, each one which is 16.0. Let me just recalculate again here quickly. So 12 times 12.01, 22 times 1.01, and 11 times 16. If I add that all together, I get 342.34 grams per mole. Mole goes underneath because this is a molar mass, so the mass of one mole of a substance. So if I'm asked to calculate how many grams of substance I've got, how do I do it? Well, I multiply by the number of moles, because if I have moles on top, I multiply by moles on the bottom, those are going to cancel out. So 2.51 moles times 342.34 grams per mole. Again, the moles cancel out. I'm left with just grams. And your numbers might have varied a little bit depending on how you rounded, but based on the numbers I've got here, the answer to two decimals is going to be 859.27 grams. Now the next two, I think maybe you all were caught off guard by the naming questions, even though I had thought I had said that there was going to be naming of compounds on the exam. So the ones you all did better at were the ones where you saw the formula and you had to go to names. The ones that you all struggled with were where you were given the names and you had to go back to formulas. So you probably won't have specific questions on naming again until the final, but again, the reason we're going over these is to get you ready for the final. So going from the formulas to names. First one, Fe, then parentheses NO3, 3. So you did have to know your polyatomic ions, the ones that were on the table in the text. So NO3 is nitrate, which has a single negative charge. The reason for this problem we had to know the charge is iron is a transition metal. It's one of those elements that can have more than one possible charge to it. So because nitrate is a negative one charge, that means this was iron 3. So this is iron 3 nitrate. Now, it's not iron 3 trinitrate. We don't use any prefixes to say how many nitrates we've got because we know that automatically by knowing what the charge on iron is. So next one, CaO. Ca is calcium. And then O, normally yes, is oxygen, but remember that the anions get slightly different names when they're in compounds. So oxygen turns into oxide. So this is the compound calcium oxide. Next one, Mg, parentheses OH2. Mg is magnesium. If you haven't heard of it before, there is another element, manganese, that's Mn. It's right next to iron on the periodic table. So just to keep those straight, Mg, that's magnesium. OH, that was one of our polyatomic ions, that's hydroxide. So this is magnesium hydroxide. Next one, Li2CO3. Li is lithium. And then CO3, another one of our polyatomic ions, that's carbonate. So lithium carbonate. Next one, NaNO2. So you have NO3, which is nitrate with an A, NO2, that's nitrite with an I. So Na is sodium, this is sodium nitrite. Then the last one from this problem, KBr. K is potassium. And yes, B is bromine, but when it's an anion like this, it becomes bromide. Questions on any of those naming problems? Okay, then the one going the other direction. So we have aluminum bicarbonate. So what I had done in class is to come up with each ion first and then put them together. So aluminum, that's Al, and based on the fact that it's in the third column of the periodic table, the third main group, that means it's going to be a +3 charge. Bicarbonate is another name for hydrogen carbonate. So that's carbonate that has a hydrogen on it. Hydrogen by itself is +1, carbonate's a -2, so hydrogen carbonate altogether is a -1 charge. So since aluminum is +3, but bicarbonate is just -1, you have Al, then parentheses, HCO3, and then a 3 again outside the parentheses. And that one outside the parentheses means you have 3 bicarbonates in this substance. Next one, ammonium phosphate. So ammonium is NH4+, phosphate is PO4-3. So you need 3 ammonium, so in parentheses you'll have NH4, outside the parentheses you'll have a 3, and then there's only 1 phosphate, so you don't need parentheses around it. You just write PO4. Potassium sulfate. So potassium is K at a single plus. Sulfate is SO4-2. So we need 2 potassiums to go with the sulfate. Since potassium is just a single atom, you don't need parentheses around it. So it's just K2SO4. Now next one, hydrogen sulfide. So the IDE ending, like sulfide, that means it's just an individual atom. If you have ate, A-T-E, or ite, I-T-E, that's when it's combined with oxygen. So hydrogen by itself, first column, it's a plus. Sulfide, being in the same column as oxygen, it's a -2. So put the two together, you get H2S. Similarly here, we have beryllium nitride. So beryllium, second column, +2. Nitrogen, one more column away from oxygen, so it's a -3. You've got to make the charges balance out. So if you swap the numbers, Be3, N2, that would make it neutral, because we'd have 3 +2s, which would give us a total of +6. We'd have 2 -3s, which would give us -6. So plus 6 and minus 6 would balance out. And then last one, iron 2, cyanide. The fact that we have the 2 there for iron tells us it's a plus 2 charge. Cyanide is Cn, and it's a single minus. So the compound is Fe, parentheses, Cn2. So the next problem was about electronegativity. First, you're asked to define the term electronegativity, explain the difference between a covalent and ionic bond, and explain how electronegativity can be used to determine what kind of bond that you have. So electronegativity is the ability of an atom to pull electrons to itself, which normally when I've said that, I've said it's in the situation where atoms are in a bond. So how can you tell which kind of bond is going to form? Well, if you have atoms that have similar electronegativity, that means one does not pull much harder than the other, and that's when they end up sharing electrons. If you have atoms that have very different electronegativity, a big difference between them, that's when you end up with an ionic bond. So usually if you have atoms that are right next to each other on the periodic table, that's generally when you get covalent. And when you have atoms that are opposite sides of the table, that's when you tend to get ionic. What is a covalent bond then? Well, it's a bond where electrons are shared. An ionic bond is where electrons are normally transferred. One atom gets electron or electrons, the other loses it. So you end up with ions, and those ions end up attracting each other. Next problem. There were 5 molecules, and you're asked something about Vesper theory. So let me just write the molecules into the notes here. We had formaldehyde, silane, hydrogen sulfide, phosphorus trichloride, and then hydrogen cyanide. So the question says that Vesper can be used to predict the shapes of molecules. You're asked to briefly explain the logic behind how to predict the shapes in Vesper theory. So if you just wrote out the phrase Vesper itself, valence shell electron pair repulsion, that tells you the logic. It's the idea that electrons want to get as far away from each other as possible because they have similar charge. So the shapes are based on atoms or electrons trying to get as far away from each other as possible. The first of these molecules, because there's just 3 bonds and no lone pairs around the center atom, that's trigonal planar. The next one, because it's 4 equal bonds, that's tetrahedral. The next one, we've got lone pairs on the center atom and only 2 atoms attached, so that makes it bent. The next one has 3 atoms, but it also has a lone pair, so that makes it trigonal pyramidal. And then the last one only has 2 bonds and no lone pairs, so it's linear. The follow-up question was about polarity. You're told that both individual bonds and whole molecules can be polar or nonpolar. So you explain how a molecule with polar bonds can be nonpolar. And that's if the bonds are arranged symmetrically so that they all cancel out with each other. Then you're asked to go back to the molecules from the previous problem and determine whether or not they were polar. So all of these were polar except for one of them. The first one, even though it's trigonal planar, there's different types of atoms around the center atom. So the bonds don't all cancel out, so it's polar. The shapes with lone pairs end up being polar because there's nothing to balance out those lone pairs. The last one, even though it's linear, which means in other cases it might be nonpolar, Again, in this case, we've got two different bonds, so it ends up being polar. So the only one that was nonpolar was the tetrahedral one, because the tetrahedral shape can be nonpolar, and we've got the same atom all the way around. Okay, two questions left. The next question was about valence electrons. First, you were asked to define what valence electrons are, and those are electrons that are in the outer shell of an atom. And then you were asked to write full electron configurations for sulfur and for oxygen. So oxygen has a total of 8 electrons. It would be 1s2, 2s2, 2p4. And sulfur is in the next row down. So it ends in the same way, 3s2, 3p4. Its full configuration would be 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2, 3p4. You were asked to underline the valence electrons, which those are the ones that are in the last shell, and that would be both the s and the p electrons that are in the outer shell for each atom. So the s and the p, those are the subshells. Those are a finer division. In these electron configurations, each number that goes in front, that tells us the shell. So for oxygen, both the 2s and the 2p's are part of the valence shell. And for sulfur, the 3s and the 3p are both part of the valence shell. So both of these atoms have 6 valence electrons. Oops. One second. There we go. So both atoms have 6 valence electrons. So both atoms need 2 electrons. To reach an octet. That's why both of them end up becoming the same charge, which was the last part of the question. So then the last question was, define what the terms period and group mean. A period is a row on the periodic table. A group is a column. You're asked to write symbols for a halogen and an atomic symbol for a noble gas. So in case that I graded it incorrectly, some of you may have had access, I think maybe on my table I list some of the elements that are blank here on this periodic table, so I forgot to consider those. So I don't remember the names without looking, but if you have one of these UU elements that's in the right place, but if I didn't grade it correctly, let me know. Because for halogens, what I was more looking for were the common ones, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, or iodine, the elements that are in the second to last column. And then for noble gases, those are ones in the last column. So helium, neon, argon, krypton, xenon, or radon. So if any of you had any questions you wanted to ask about the exam, do come up to me later or do come up in office hours. Now we're going to be moving back to chapter 6. The other day we had started talking about solids, liquids, and gases. So we'd gotten through the first section of the chapter where we were talking about the different phases of matter. And now we were starting to talk about intermolecular forces. So intermolecular forces are attractions that can occur between atoms or molecules. And the main type of force we had gotten to talking about were permanent dipoles. So remember, a dipole, that's the term used to describe this separation of charge that you can get in a bond or in a molecule. And so I had talked about how if you have two different molecules with dipoles, those dipoles can attract each other. The positive of one molecule can attract the negative of another. And that's one of the stronger intermolecular forces. The strongest would actually be if you had full ions, because ions are full charges. Dipoles end up generating just partial charges. So if you have ions attracting each other, that's the stronger of the forces. But outside of that, if you have dipoles attract each other, that's one of the next strongest forces. Now, what I don't think I had time to talk about properly were dispersion forces. And these are attractive forces created by temporary dipoles. And a simple example where this happens is in the molecule iodine. So if you draw out the structure for iodine, it turns out this is one of those elements that naturally exists as a diatomic molecule. Di meaning two, so this means an atom that has two of the same element in it. So since it's only two atoms connected to each other, this is automatically a linear shape. And since we had just talked about polarity a little bit ago, if you have two atoms that are the same, then they're going to have the same electronegativity. And so if you look at this bond in iodine, the bond is going to be nonpolar. Two elements or two atoms that have exactly the same electronegativity. So since the only thing in terms of molecular shape is this one bond, that means the whole molecule is nonpolar. But iodine as a substance exists as a solid at room temperature. Now, why does that matter? Well, you might remember me talking last time about a couple of small molecules, ethane, methane, water. And what we were doing is looking at the shapes of these molecules and relating that to whether the molecules were polar or not. So something like water, even though it's a really small molecule, it happens to be really polar. So water has a lot of attractions, even at room temperature, enough to pull water into a condensed phase, into being a liquid. But something like methane, swamp gas, ethane, propane, like you might have in lighters, ethane and propane are heavier molecules than water, but they only exist as gases at room temperature. And that's because they're nonpolar molecules. They don't have the attractions that water does. So stating that iodine is a solid means that it must have some intermolecular forces, even though it's a nonpolar molecule. And here's what's going on. Iodine is a very large atom. If you look at the periodic table, it's on row 5 of the periodic table. So it's a much larger atom than things like bromine, chlorine, or fluorine. And that means the electrons have the potential to be pushed around as the molecule is vibrating in space. So something that molecular structures don't show very well is that anything that's got a temperature has got motion to it. So in water molecules, they're not just fixed structures. Those bonds are constantly moving or vibrating around. Same thing that can happen in iodine. So what can happen is that because of the way that iodine moves, maybe just temporarily for a moment, one side ends up with more electrons around it than the other. So that means you get a partial charge, a partial positive and a partial negative. But those charges may move or disappear as the molecule keeps moving around. But because the atoms are large enough, it generates enough of these temporary charges that that's what gives iodine these intermolecular forces that are able to hold it together as a solid. And so these types of temporary dipoles, ones that aren't due to the structure itself, but due just to the way that the molecules are moving around in space, those temporary dipoles are called dispersion forces. So now that I told the story, let me write this down in the notes, what we were just talking about. So temporary dipoles can be created in two different ways. One, molecules can experience a sudden, uneven distribution of electrons. Due to the molecule moving around in space. And that's the case I just talked about with iodine. But there's another way that these temporary dipoles can be generated, which is a nonpolar molecule can be forced to have a dipole if it gets near another molecule that already has a dipole. So let's say that you have something like water. Water will always have a dipole on it because of its molecular structure. Well, let's say that water gets up against some molecule, which we won't worry about the exact identity, but let's say that the positive part of water moves up against some other molecule. Well, if water is positive at one end, then wherever it gets closest to this other molecule, it's going to pull a little bit of negative charge to the surface because positive and negative attract each other. But that means if you've made or induced this charge on the surface, somewhere else, there's got to be a little bit of positive charge that gets generated. So the other way that you can end up with these temporary dipoles is what's known as induction. To induce means to cause something by this interaction. So a polar molecule can induce, which means cause, a dipole to form on a nonpolar molecule. So if there are enough of these temporary dipoles around, they can create intermolecular forces that can cause liquids or solids to form. So this is the way that, for example, fats can be held together. Most fat molecules are not terribly polar, but they're awfully large molecules. It would take a while to write the structure down. That's the only reason I'm not writing an example down. But they could have up to hundreds of atoms on them. So with such a large surface area, you get a lot of chance for the molecules to interact with each other, exactly with these types of temporary dipoles that can be created. So with the large surface area, with the large number of temporary dipoles, that's what holds the molecules together as liquids or solids, even though the molecules are polar. So these forces due to temporary dipoles are known as dispersion forces. And because I gave the specific example of iodine, It's a nice small molecule, easy to visualize. Let me write down the story about iodine. So iodine, I2, is a nonpolar molecule. Because it is linear, and it is composed of two of the same atom. So another way of saying that it's nonpolar is that it has no permanent dipole. But iodine is a large atom, and I won't write this term down, but to use the term that's often used, iodine is very polarizable, meaning that it's not polar on its own, but the electrons are easily moved around. The way that you could say it is iodine is big and squishy, so it's able to have this sudden formation of temporary dipoles. So because iodine is a large atom, it is able to form temporary dipoles. Temporary dipoles. And the dispersion forces in iodine are strong enough that iodine can form a solid at room temperature. So now we've got permanent dipoles, we've got temporary dipoles, the dispersion forces. So there's one type of intermolecular force that the chapter gets into, which is really a subset of dipoles interacting, and those are known as hydrogen bonds. So hydrogen bonds, those are dipole attractions created whenever a molecule has hydrogen connected to oxygen, nitrogen, or fluorine. And why does it end up being those three atoms specifically? Because there's a large difference in electronegativity. And so hydrogen bonds are really just a special case of dipole attractions, but they're a very important one. And I've already mentioned, I think, out loud some of the cases where hydrogen bonding really matters. Of course, one of the easiest cases is in water itself. Water has a large number of unusual properties. Did I already talk about... I must have already talked about snowflakes a little bit, right? And the idea that water becomes less dense when it freezes because the hydrogen bonds, these dipole attractions, pull water molecules apart, creating space, which creates something that's less dense. Hydrogen bonding is also what causes Kevlar to have its strength. I think I'd mentioned that. Even DNA itself, if you've never learned anything about DNA, you have two halves of this huge molecule, this really indefinitely long molecule, that the two halves are held together just by these types of attractions, these hydrogen bonding interactions. So biologically, hydrogen bonding plays a huge role. So that is the third type of intermolecular force. So anyone have any questions on anything that, we've discussed so far about intermolecular forces today? Okay, then I want to talk for a few moments about what happens in solution, because the text goes on after it defines these different type of intermolecular forces to talk about the types of things, types of forces that are experienced in solution. So the first situation I want to talk about is aqueous solutions. Of ions. Remember that aqueous means water-based, which I think last time we did get our sol words in, soluble, solute, solvent. So water being the solvent makes it the aqueous solution. So what happens when you put something like sodium chloride in solution is that those ions break apart. So here I've got a sodium ion, a chloride ion. Water is polar, and whichever end is more compatible with the ion is going to end up turning towards the ion. So you would have the oxygens in water surrounding the sodium when it's floating around in solution. Because remember, the oxygens are partially negatively charged. For chlorine, it's going to be the opposite. You're going to have the hydrogens, which are pointed more towards the chlorine, because the hydrogens are partially positively charged. So a way that we can say this is that the ions are hydrated in solution. They're surrounded by water. Now, I don't remember if the text goes into this or not, but you don't just get one layer of water. You can get these what are called spheres of hydration, where you end up with one layer of water molecules around the ion, and then another layer around that, and another layer around that, that help to surround the ions. And that's what actually allows them to dissolve in water. So I want to step outside the text and go just a little bit further for a second, because there are some ionic substances that you can throw in water, and they won't break apart. They won't dissolve. There are some substances like salt that you throw them in water, and we all have the common experience that, yes, they'll dissolve in water. Why is it that some ions do dissolve in water and some don't? The simple answer has to deal with whether the ions are more attracted to themselves or whether the ions are more attracted to water. Because what is it that holds an ionic compound together? Ionic bonds are just ions of opposite charges clinging to each other. So sodium chloride, the reason it exists as is table salt, the reason it exists as a solid, is because those ions are clinging on to each other. When you put that substance into water, now you have the ions being surrounded by water instead. And they'll stay in water because of the attraction that water has with the ions. But suppose that the attractions between ions are even stronger than that. Well, then it turns out that those ions will want to cling together and stay as a solid. And so that's the essential reason why certain ionic substances dissolve in water and certain ones don't. And let me just write that much of it down, because that's not too far beyond what the text gets into. So when an ionic substance is able to dissolve in water, it is because the ions separate and are surrounded by water. Let me just say that again and emphasize. If the ions didn't separate, they'd stay stuck together as a solid. So the fact that you can end up with a solution, the fact that the salt disperses itself through water, is because the ions are coming apart. So some ionic substances are not soluble. They're not soluble in water because the attractions between ions is stronger than the attraction between the ions and water. There is a little bit more to the story than that, but we're not ready for it yet because there's certain sections of the text that we haven't gotten to yet. So I am simplifying a little bit, but this is mostly the story. Do the ions prefer to interact with each other? Do the ions prefer to interact with water? So if they're more compatible with water, they're able to dissolve in water. If they're more compatible with each other, then they'll stay just clumped together as a solid, even though you throw it in the water. Now, later on, we'll talk about a reaction that can happen, where if you take two different solutions, for example, if you have silver nitrate, silver nitrate can be in one container on its own, and you can put sodium chloride in a container on its own, and both of those substances will end up dissolving. But if you then pour the mixtures together, then silver and chlorine will encounter each other in the solution. When that happens, they do prefer to stick together than to be in water. So silver that was in its own container, chlorine that was in its own container, those can be solutions. But you mix them together and you'll see a solid suddenly form and then drop out of solution. And that's known as a precipitate. So we'll talk about precipitation in a later chapter, but it's related to this whole idea of ions interacting in water. Question, yeah. That's right. And then the further the story, as long as the ions are kept separate, then those ions may still be able to dissolve in water. But those particular combinations where, like you said, the bonds are stronger, then if they encounter each other in water, they'll form a precipitate. So we got just a little time before our break. The last thing that I wanted to talk about is what happens when something like sugar is put into water. So this was aqueous solution of ions. What about aqueous solutions of covalent molecules? Sugar is a huge molecule, so I'm going to use a smaller example. We have water and ethanol. Ethanol has this structure to it. It's a 2-carbon compound. Ethanol is the substance in alcoholic beverages that make it an alcoholic beverage. As a side story, the term alcohol in chemistry doesn't mean just the specific compound. An alcohol is any carbon-containing compound that has an oxygen and hydrogen attached to the carbon. And so there's tons of biological molecules that could be classified as alcohols. Not all of them are drinkable. A very good example is wood alcohol. wood alcohol, methanol, only has one carbon in it. And if you drink it, instead of you getting intoxicated, it can cause blindness. So just wanted to talk about what the term alcohol means, because in everyday use, the term alcohol usually means just this stuff that's in alcoholic beverages. Now, if we look at the structures of water and ethanol, you could see that we've got these OH bonds in them. And you might remember earlier me talking about what hydrogen bonding is. That's an interaction that can occur between these two different molecules because the oxygen-hydrogen bonds are very polar. So this is the type of interaction that can occur between these two types of molecules in solution. But the ethanol itself doesn't have to break apart in order to be able to be dispersed through water. And that's because ethanol is a covalent substance. What makes ethanol ethanol is the fact that the atoms are all bonded to each other. But one molecule of ethanol can have these polar attractions to another molecule of ethanol that doesn't require the molecule being broken apart to move the molecules apart. That's different than what we were just talking about with ionic compounds. Ionic compounds, the only reason an ionic compound would form a solid is if all the ions attract each other. So ethanol can form a solid only just because of attractions. So the reason I'm saying this is what happens in solution is a little different. If ethanol and water mix, it's not because of ions attracting each other, it's just dipoles. And water can be attracted to itself, ethanol can be attracted to itself, but as long as the combination of the two is a stronger attraction overall, well, then the two substances can mix. Yes? Its shape may change slightly, you know, that something else is tugging on that pair of electrons, but all these molecules are still freely floating around in space as well. So these attractions don't end up being fixed. Like one molecule can be attracted to another, but because it's wiggling around, another molecule may take its place. So its shape may change just temporarily, but because there's all these different interactions happening over time, overall, the shape mostly gets maintained the same. How would it produce a solid? So in this case, you'd have to cool the mixture down enough so that the molecules are moving slowly enough that these intermolecular forces that are there become strong enough compared to how much the molecules are moving that they lock the molecules into place. In fact, after the break, I'll answer that question again in a little more detail because that's an important question related to what's in the chapter here. So room temperature, there's too much motion in the molecules for those forces to hold them still. There's enough force there to keep them from totally evaporating away from each other, so it keeps it from becoming a gas, but there's not enough attractions to keep them as a solid at room temperature. So let me come back and talk more about that after our break, though, because I'm running a little over our break time. So let me write down a little bit of what I said here about aqueous solutions of covalent molecules. Ethanol and other covalent substances form solids and liquids not because of ions attracting, but because of intermolecular forces. Which we could simplify and just say dipoles. This means that when covalent substances dissolve in water, those substances do not have to have bonds break. And again, that's different than in ionic substances. In ionic substances, when ions move apart to go into water, that's because those ionic bonds are breaking. When covalent substances break apart in water, the molecules still stay intact. But the attractions between molecules are overcome. In fact, that's a good way for me to write it down. The molecules remain intact as the IMF, the intermolecular forces, are overcome. That's the main difference between covalent substances in solution versus ionic substances. So let's go ahead and take our break now. Before the break, there's this question asked about what would cause a mixture like ethanol water to become a solid versus a liquid versus a gas. And I wanted to give a little bit more complete answer to that question. In order to do that, I just wanted to make a statement of temperature. Temperature, to simplify, is a measure of the average kinetic energy of the atoms or molecules in a sample. Now, I know that some of you have not had physics before, so what the term kinetic energy means is literally the energy of motion. So an object, just based on how fast it's traveling, has a certain amount of energy associated with that, and that's known as kinetic energy. And even though we can't see it at our human scale, all substances around us have some amount of motion in the atoms or molecules within them. So what causes something to form a solid versus a liquid or a gas depends on the balance between two things. How much energy is there in terms of temperature? So how much motion is there in the molecules? And then how strong are the attractive forces between molecules? So a solid or a liquid will form when the attractive forces between molecules, which means the intermolecular forces, are able to overcome the kinetic energy due to temperature. So water molecules are going to be moving around automatically just based on their temperature. But water molecules have a lot of attractive forces. If there's enough of these attractive forces to overcome the fact that the molecules would otherwise be moving, well, that will cause the molecules to stick together. And just how much attractive force there is would determine whether whether water is going to exist as a liquid, which means they're stuck together but still able to move around, or whether it would exist as a solid, which means they're more fixed in space. They're more frozen in terms of their motion. So a solid liquid will melt or boil when kinetic energy due to temperature increases to the point that the attractive forces, the IMFs, the intermolecular forces, are no longer able to hold molecules together. So I'll say a little bit more about this when we reach the end of the chapter, because there's a diagram in one of the breakout sections of your chapter known as a phase diagram, which shows you which state of matter you're going to get depending on the temperature or the pressure that's in the environment. But we still have gases to talk about, so I want to get through the discussion of gases before we get to this phase diagram. But if I double-check the syllabus, I think I've managed to actually get ahead a little bit here in lecture. And let me just confirm that. Yes, so technically I'm not supposed to be getting to gases until Thursday. So I'll say this, for the purposes of the quiz that's on Thursday, it will not include gases. Because of that, maybe I should go ahead and do the review for the quiz. So quiz two is going to have a mixture of conceptual and mathematical problems. The main mathematical problem you'll have is something related to stoichiometry, calculating amounts of reactants or products. Most of the rest of what we've covered is still theoretical in nature, though. So more definition or theory type questions, but you will have a couple of calculation style questions as well. So the one thing that you're sure to have, because I left it off of the exam, is Lewis dot structures. Now that both sections had the opportunity to go through that lab exercise, we're all equally prepared to be able to handle Lewis dot structures. So those will be on the quiz since I had left them off the exam. Other than that, there's going to be nothing that's directly from chapters 1 through 4 that's going to show up on the quiz, because all of that information was on the more recent exam. So the rest of the quiz is going to be everything from chapter 5 and 6, but only those sections that we so far have covered. So in chapter 5, the topics we covered were balancing equations. And they won't be any more difficult than the type of examples we'd already done in class. So remember that the way that we balance the equations is to look for something that only shows up once on the left and the right-hand side. Like we had done a combustion example where we saw that carbon only existed in one reactant, it only existed in one product. So we balanced it first before we balanced some of the other elements. The same logic will work for whatever example that I happen to give on the quiz. Then we skipped over section 2, and we're still skipping section 2 because that's more of a historical note, although maybe next time, if I'm still running ahead, I'll come back and make a comment about it. So the next thing is molar mass and the AMU. So specifically, what is an AMU? It is 1/12 the mass of a carbon 12 atom. What's its relationship to the mole? Remember that one mole of AMUs is equal to 1 gram. That's why, if we're talking about atomic masses, then the numbers on the periodic table, those atomic masses, we can use the atomic mass unit for. Or if we're talking about moles of a substance, that's why we're able to talk about grams. Because if you take a mole and multiply it by AMU, you get grams. Then the main part of chapter 5 is stoichiometry, which means dealing with ratios. So to translate that into freer English, it's calculating how much product can be produced or how much reactant is needed. In the examples in class, we did one of each of those. We had one problem where I started with a reactant, and I said, how much product are we going to be able to make? And then the next time I did an example, I took how much reactant do we have, and we calculated how much of another reactant would we need. Both of those problems were worked exactly in the same way, where we had a series of three different conversion factors. So as a reminder, what we did is we went from grams to moles. In this case, moles of reactant. Then we converted to moles using the reaction equation. So we either took moles reactant to figure out moles of product or moles of reactant to figure out moles of the other reactant. The questions we did in class wanted the answers in grams. So the last conversion factor we did was to convert back into grams again. That was the main part of chapter 5. There was a little bit more at the end of the chapter that we discussed because it got into solutions. So that includes some of the terminology that we covered, like solute, solvent, and dissolve, and soluble. Aside just from knowing what solutions are, we had some concentration units. And the units I cared most about are molarity and percent mass. Related to percent mass, I also talked about PPM, parts per million. So the calculation of percent mass and PPM is the same. It's the mass of one substance divided by the total mass you have. For percent, you then multiply by 100. For PPM, parts per million, you would multiply by a million. Any questions about anything in Chapter 5? Okay, then we also had chapter 6, part of it, that we've covered so far. So first part of chapter 6 deals with phases of matter. So that's solid, liquid, and gas. And we had talked about each one of those phases from their microscopic versus macroscopic perspectives. Microscopic means down on the molecular level. So the fact that solids have molecules or atoms which are pretty much locked into place, they're condensed phases. Liquids have atoms or molecules that are also condensed, which means they're stuck to each other, but they have more motion. And then a gas is where the particles are completely free from each other. The macroscopic would be describing the shape or the volume that these phases form. So solids have a fixed shape to them, but liquids and gases have a variable shape. Solids and liquids have a fixed volume, gases do not. So those last descriptions I gave were the microscopic, the large scale. Talking about molecules and structure, that's the microscopic, the small scale. We did talk about terms for phase changes. There's some of the easy ones that you encounter in everyday life, like freezing and melting. But we also talked about a couple of the more obscure terms. To go from a solid directly to a vapor, that's sublimation. To go from a vapor back to a solid, that's deposition. So there were six terms total. There was melting, boiling, sublimation, freezing, condensation, and deposition. So you need to know those six phase change terms. There's a diagram I drew, which just to save time, let me flash it up on the screen here. There's a diagram I drew that showed the relationship between temperature and energy added. I'm not going to be asking about that diagram, not for the quiz at least. So we still haven't covered section two, so I'm going to skip it again for now. And so the major thing that we've been talking about then is intermolecular forces, which from the way that your text describes them, there's three that we've talked about. There's dipole, dipole attractions, there's dispersion forces, with iodine being a big example of where dispersion forces have an effect. And then we did also talk about hydrogen bonding. So that's section three. The only other thing that we talked about is in section four. And that's from forming solutions with covalent versus ionic substances. The fact that for an ionic substance to dissolve in water, at least, requires that the ions are pulled apart from each other. For a covalent substance, that means that the different molecules of covalent substance have to be pulled apart, but the molecules themselves can remain intact. That's the main concept there. So, did anyone have any questions about the material that's going to end up on the quiz? Yes? So it's all of chapter 5 except for section 2, and chapter 6, we haven't covered gases at all. So we skipped section 2 in chapter 6, and then whatever I happen to get through today in terms of gases will not be on the quiz. Any other questions? Yes? Thursday. This coming Thursday, which it's listed on the syllabus. I did get that date right? Yeah. Hold on. Let me look at the syllabus, make sure I didn't do something wrong. Yes, 5-9. That's this Thursday, so that's the second quiz. Okay. So just to make clear, anything below this line is not on quiz number 2. So the last part of the chapter is all about gases. And I want to get into a topic of what is known as an ideal gas. So an ideal gas is a theoretical gas in which gases of any substances all have the same behavior. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, jumping ahead a little bit, let's say I have something like hydrogen gas, H2. Hydrogen is like iodine. It's a molecule that only has two atoms of it. It's only got two of the same atom, so it has no permanent dipole of its own. And so hydrogen molecules tend not to be very attracted to each other. That's versus something like water. Water is very polar, which means water molecules are very attracted to each other. So even if we know nothing more about gases, we might guess that the way that water behaves when it's a gas might be quite different than the way that hydrogen behaves when it's a gas. But it turns out there's certain properties of gases that are all related to each other, and these properties can be related by a nice, really simple equation if we make certain assumptions about the way that the gases behave. And that's what an ideal gas is. It's this theoretical gas where we simplify the behavior of gases that allows us to write one equation that'll explain any of their behavior. Then in real life, if we needed to, we can make some small adjustments. But for right now, we're only going to talk about these ideal gases. And where we're going to start is a theory known as kinetic molecular theory, which, let me explain what's going on there. Even before we do that, I guess we should talk about the physical properties that gases experience. Oh, yes, question. You're going to get one of them back on... Yes, which... Since you brought that up, for section two, if you can hold on for a moment just after class, I can run and get those to hand back now, so you can have them to review between now and Thursday. So, yes, good point. Maybe, in fact, we'll end just a minute or two early so I can get the papers to hand back. Okay. So, back to talking about gases. This kinetic molecular theory is a way of looking at gases like they're individual particles all bouncing around, for example, inside of some container. So the kinetic energy of the molecules ends up being one of these important properties we talk about, which kinetic energy, that's related to temperature. Another property of a gas that ends up being important is how much space does the gas have to bounce around in? In other words, the volume of the container. The last important property is the pressure of a gas. Now, again, I know that some of you have not had any physics before. So let me just define what pressure is. Pressure is equal to force divided by the area that that force is applied over. So force, if you haven't had physics, one way of thinking of force is weight is a type of force. And so imagine that I was to take, what do I have in this example here? Well, let's say that I have this battery charger here. And if I were to put our textbook on top of the battery charger and put that on my hand, does it look like I'm in any large amount of physical pain? No, because this weight of the book is distributed all across this charger. So when it's on my hand, it's just me holding a book and a charger. But let's say that I took a pen and I had just the tip of the pen that was somehow balanced on my hand. And if now I was able to balance the textbook on that pen and have it sit just on the tip, probably wouldn't feel quite so comfortable, would it? Even though it's the same textbook involved, it's the same weight, which means there's the same amount of force involved, but it's all funneled through this little point on the pen tip. Well, that's what pressure is, how much force you have versus the area that force is applied in. I mean, a very practical example where this shows up is if you sharpen a knife. When you sharpen a knife, it's not that there's some chemical change going on necessarily. You're lowering that surface area so that when you apply the knife to whatever you're cutting, that force that you're using is funneled through a much narrower surface. That means you have a much greater pressure, which is the whole reason that the knife works the way it does. So gases have pressure because this kinetic energy they have, to be a little sloppy with the way I'm talking about the physics, that translates into a type of force. These molecules are bouncing around hitting the container. So when they hit the container, how much surface area there is versus how much force that these molecules have in terms of motion, that tells us the pressure. So eventually we're going to come up with some relationship between temperature, volume, and pressure. That's where this discussion is going to lead. Now, so maybe that helps to define ideal gases a little better. That if we make certain assumptions about how the gases behave, we end up with this really simple one equation expression for how pressure, temperature, and volume are all related to each other. So what are these assumptions that we make? Well, I'm going to simplify that the way that the book discusses these. Because one aspect is that we pretend that gas molecules all travel in straight lines. That doesn't mean they can't bump into things. That doesn't mean they can't bump into each other. But as they're zooming around in space, we assume that they're just like little particles that are all moving in straight lines. Another assumption we make is this, that gas molecules effectively have no volume. Now, afterwards, I wrote here, would affect V, which means volume. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, I said that one of the physical properties of gases we're going to be worried about is the volume they occupy, meaning the container that they're in. Well, what if gas molecules happen to be huge themselves? Like, imagine that you fill up a container with a bunch of marbles. Well, the amount of space that the marbles have to occupy is going to be taken away from by the fact that the marbles themselves occupy space. So same thing is true with gas molecules. If gas molecules were huge, then that would subtract away from the space they would have to bounce around in, which is going to indirectly affect their temperature or their pressure. So if we wanted to make it where all gases behave the same, no matter what gas we're talking about, we're going to pretend that they all exist as little points, little dots that have no size to them, or meaning that molecules have effectively no volume. The way that the book, I think, expresses it is that it says the distance between gas molecules is large relative to their size. But it's easier just to say to pretend that molecules have no volume. Another one of these characteristics of an ideal gas is gas molecules have no intermolecular forces, no IMFs. What if they did? What if it was something like water? So this is related to pressure, because pressure is a measure of how much the molecules are able to collide against the sides of a container. Well, if the molecules are attracted to each other, that means they're not going to be bouncing into the container as much, which means it would affect their pressure. And then there's one other common restriction that we put in, which is that if gas molecules collide, they don't lose any energy. If they did lose energy, remember I said that temperature is a measure of average kinetic energy. So if they lost energy, it would affect temperature. So just to have written it down once somewhere, because it'll be next time before we get to it, the equation we're going to end up with is this. P for pressure, V for volume, is equal to N, that's number of moles, R is just a constant that we'll talk about, and T is temperature. But that means the three physical properties, pressure, volume, and temperature, are all rolled into this one nice, really simple equation, which this equation is known as the ideal gas law. And as long as we make these three assumptions, all gases then become just like each other, and so they all obey this ideal gas law. Well, a logical thing to say is, well, how accurate is this law if you're making these assumptions? And over certain ranges of pressure or temperature, the law actually works out pretty well. It turns out that this last restriction, that gases wouldn't lose any energy on collision, that still ends up being pretty much true even in real gases. The thing that really makes a difference is how much intermolecular forces they have. But we'll talk about those corrections once we work our way up to the ideal gas law.